Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. This is your host, John McCoy, and this time we have two co-hosts. Alphabetically, they are Shannon Camp.
Hi.
And Carolyn Fulford.
Hi, everyone.
And I thought it would be appropriate to have two guest hosts this time because we are doing two short stories by two of the most famous American short story writers of the 20th century, Shirley Jackson and Flannery O'Connor.
I have to say, they go very well together.
They do. They are often paired together. And as soon as I threw this out there as a possibility, both of you seemed very interested in this. You want to talk a little bit about your history with one or both?
Sure. I think I came to Flannery O'Connor through school because I went to Catholic school, and she was part of the more like advanced assigned reading sometimes in either English or your any number of religion classes. So I came to her through that, but I think it was like a teacher who handed me a short story of hers to read because she sensed I was getting bored. So it was like extra credit, essentially.
This is actually my first time doing a close reading of O'Connor, I think. I believe I've read some of her short stories before, but this was the first time I really closely paid attention to one. But I came to really love Shirley Jackson during my senior year of college because of the book We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which I actually read while I was semi-housebound myself. So it really struck like a weird chord with me. But I had already read The Lottery in school. I remember reading it in junior high. And I actually kind of went to the mat over the story the year after I graduated college because I was working with these guys who were creating a play to be taken to junior highs and high schools that were all famous short stories brought to life. And not only did, out of the short stories they picked, there was not a single female author, but there was also a cast of 10 men and one woman. And so I was talking to them and I said, you know, if this were a show for adults, I might not say anything at all, but you're going to be taking this to school children. Like, how can you justify showing this much gender bias? And they were like, well, there just really aren't any famous short stories written by women that we could find to use. There really weren't any featuring female characters.
Oh, are you kidding me?
And I, you know, I shoot back immediately. The Lottery by Shirley Jackson is the most anthologized short story of all time. Yeah. Like, this is the most thin BS excuse I've ever heard. And then they read it and they were like, oh, but it's so dark. And I said, you included The Most Dangerous Game and The Telltale Heart and you think The Lottery is too dark? But I guess that just goes to show, like, unlike those two stories, which are quite fantastical, I think The Lottery really strikes a chord of, like, real dread with people. There's something realistic about it, if not the actual lottery itself, then the sentiments.
Both Flannery O'Connor and Shirley Jackson were considered extremely shocking in their day. And as you bring up, nobody bats an eye at someone like Edgar Allan Poe writing about people getting bricked up in walls. Somehow, I think in post-war America, the idea that women would write about such violent subjects was seen as just beyond the pale. I mean, today, of course, both of them are well-beloved. And I would also add to them, perhaps, if you want to go even further, someone like Patricia Highsmith as a third post-war woman writer who wrote in genre fiction that was, on the surface, just kind of hard-boiled crime, but was, I think, under that, a very piercing.
It's also worth noting that at the time, the content of their stories was also used to kind of like armchair psychoanalyze the writers. A lot of the criticism, like the early reviews of their stuff, all had like this seems like the work of like a neurotic mm-hmm. woman or something. Like it's they were both like pathologized early on in their work.
Let's go through these stories chronologically, because why not? As you've mentioned, the Lottery, which was originally published in 1948, is one of the anthologized, or it is the most anthologized American short stories. But it was, at its time, it was published in The New Yorker, and it created a huge fuss that summer. Apparently, The New Yorker got more mail on this story than they got on any other feature they ever ran. And people were very confused by this story. They couldn't quite get a handle on what this story was about. This doesn't have much plot, this story. This does get taught a lot in school, and I remember when it was taught in my high school, there were a lot of very upset children at the end of the class.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was the first time I had read any interviews or quotes with Jackson about the writing of the story or the response to the story. And they're pretty notoriously hard to find, because Jackson said herself, and her husband said, that she was not interested in becoming like a public figure at all. She really wasn't interested in doing interviews, and like many artists, would rather let the work speak for itself. But I guess I had always assumed, maybe because of my own like experiences giving me a shape of the story, that Jackson wrote this story with one thing in mind, and that thing was like small town malaise and how communities can turn on each other and how people can be made pariahs in their own communities. But then in all of Jackson's interviews, she was talking about the story as a much larger metaphor for warfare. And it was like her reaction to the bomb being dropped in World War II and such stuff like that. So I'm sure it's possible to read it on more than one level, but I thought that was really interesting because I had never even considered that point.
I think I do remember this being assigned when I was in high school. The second sentence out of the teacher's mouth when we first discussed it was, "Who here knows what a scapegoat is?" So I was taught it mostly on like a very sort of literal level of like, this is about how we always choose someone to blame in any given situation, how that kind of like knits us together as people. I wasn't taught it at all in like a historical context. I think that might have been a little too critical of the establishment for the kind of high school didacticism that I was subject to. I think I remember reading that it was Shirley Jackson didn't really speak to that meaning of it at all. It was mostly her husband, who is a literary critic who outlived her, who like did most of the sort of public relations, like explaining what her work meant.
Oh yeah, that's true, actually, now that I think of even what I read today. I think part of my reading of this is a story about like the destructiveness of these small town or small communities could be the fact that I have, you know, more familiarity with We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which is very much about like a town of villagers who turn against people, and they don't literally try to kill them, but you could interpret certain things they do as being incredibly menacing and or threatening. So that may have colored my reading of the meaning as well.
Yeah, I also think that for her time, she was considered kind of, and she's like an anti-regionalist writer, as at least that's the term that gets thrown around in criticism of her. And I think that her very unsentimental view of places like New England, which is kind of the place from which she's drawing all this settings in her work, I think that offended a lot of people on like an aesthetic level at the time. I think that her view of society, I think, is on its surface a lot more general or just sort of like American than to compare with Flannery O'Connor, who I think also has these view of communities and society, but hers is the South. It's a specific place. It comes from a specific history, whereas I think Shirley Jackson is working from this place of like the American suburbia, like the 1950s sort of cookie cutter boxes vision America.
And I think that actually adds to the menace of the story and maybe kind of was a factor in creating so much discomfort for so many people is, even though to me the story does feel very New England, and that's true of all of Jackson's stuff, it doesn't have like specific places mentioned, like A Good Man Is Hard to Find has, you know, Florida and Tennessee and Georgia. So it sort of takes on that, oh, it could happen anywhere feel.
I think it's important to keep in mind that we live in a kind of a post-ironic society, and we're all used to these stories of small-town communities where something goes wrong or where there's something lurking below the surface. If you scratch the surface, you'll find these ancient rituals and stuff. That's a kind of a trope that we're all used to, but that was not something I think that was very common, especially in early post-war American fiction. I mean, you had people like H.P. Lovecraft who were writing stories about evil New England towns, but there everything was kind of the decay of the backwoods. Here we have a what appears to be, you know, a small town Americana that turns out to be harboring an evil secret.
I think that might coincide with the expansion of highways around this time in the U.S. I think there's this increased anxiety around the idea of the small towns or something like that. Like, I'm not sure if either of you might have picked up on that, but I feel like this 1950s era has this ability to have like this microscopic view of society at that time that I think might have been aggravated by this increasing sense of homogeneity that the American landscape would soon see.
And I think you can pick that up in the conversation that Old Man Warner has with the other person who's standing by at the lottery, like about how some small towns have stopped doing it. And it's like that whole fear of change conversation where they're mentioning that these ways are falling away, but they're going to kind of stubbornly hold to it even in the face of that. And another thing I was thinking about, because I looked up all the names that Jackson uses in the story, and the woman who's ultimately killed in the lottery is named Tessie Hutchinson. And there was a famous Massachusetts Bay colony religious pioneer named Anne Hutchinson, who was declared a heretic and excommunicated from the Puritan Church. And I thought that was interesting because it kind of lends that, witch hunt, Salem witch trials aspect to the story, which I suppose is another lens you could read it through. And I think it's kind of amusing because the Crucible would come not too long after this. And the lottery and the Crucible are so different in the sense that I think one is quite subtle with its meanings and its allusions, whereas the other is almost like a political speech turned into a play. So I was just kind of amused by the comparison there. And I think she chose all the names, obviously, incredibly intentionally, perhaps most notably Delacroix, which is pronounced Delacroix in the story, which means of the cross.
This is a story about a small town where it's a village of, that we're told, about 300 residents. And we are told the date is June 27th, actually. All the villagers are super excited because we're told that the titular lottery is coming up. And what this story does is it doesn't tell you anything about what the lottery is. It just tells you how people are looking forward to it and how people are preparing for it. And at first it seems like it could be some sort of a good thing, or maybe, you know, certainly people are hopeful that the conclusion of the lottery will bring about good things. This has a very slow burn, and
I think it makes it very satisfying. It's like, I feel like it's shaped like a funnel, the story itself, so it makes it kind of like an interesting, like the dawning realization there from the beginning if you go back and read again. And I think it kind of heightening tension is something that Jackson's very good at.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch the reactions go from generally either like ambivalent or lightly positive at the beginning of the story until as we get closer and closer to the actual draw, like people in the crowd are noted like frowning and kind of nervously adjusting themselves, and doing other things and watching each other. So it's interesting. She does a great job, like, very gradually bringing in that feeling of, like, oh no, something bad is about to happen.
There are two townspeople, a Mr. Summers and a Mr. Graves, who are sort of responsible for organizing this lottery. It's really Mr. Summers who kind of runs everything, and we're told that there is lottery paraphernalia. There's this little black box that's used in the lottery that has outlasted several generations, and so that's part of the lore. And we're told that all through the year that black box is kept in various places, including in people's barns. One year it was kept on a shelf in a general store. So it's sort of this constant presence in the town that is both, you know, ubiquitous and yet sort of mundane, too, for such a momentous piece of paraphernalia. And the night before, Mr. Summers and Mr. Graves are writing down all the slips, these little slips of papers with every family name on them. When we finally get to the lottery, I think it's interesting that it's a kind of a two-step thing. It's not just everybody gets a slip in the lottery. It's that first someone's family is chosen, and then later we will get the individual from that family. So it's kind of... as a process, it marks the family first. And one of the things I remembered as I was reading through this time was I had a hard time actually following the logistics of the lottery, because yeah. It's kind of, they have all the townspeople assemble, and then we're told everyone draws a slip, and
they start talking about people drawing for each other, which is where I was like, wait, what? But I don't know.
Yeah, I think the system as it works out is all the draw, and then all the family members of that family draw, and then they kill that person. Spoiler alert. But yeah, it's, I think the ritual, like the listing part of the ritual, I think that's when she starts using the word ritual. I think that for anyone who is reading the story as she intended it to be read would immediately think of the Holocaust, would immediately think of what was happening around mid-20th century, of, you know, the mechanics of modern society being put towards this use, which I think is a very clever sort of device on the part of the heightening tension of the story.
I think the detail that kind of arrested me the most in this part of the story is, so of the family that gets chosen to draw amongst themselves which member of the family will die, that's the Hutchinsons. There's like a toddler-aged boy named Davy Hutchinson, and Jackson includes these little details about, like, he has to reach his little hand into the box himself, but he's like not even dexterous enough to unfold the paper. So have his older brother do it, and then have his older brother hold it for him. And then, you know, they show how even like the youngest, most innocent members of this community are involved in this incredibly macabre thing, and they don't even realize, because of course they're way too young to understand the implications. But having him pick up the little pebbles at the end of the story was like one final twist of the knife.
There is a brief segment in the middle here we've talked about where the old guy, what's the old dude's name, Old Man Warner,
because he warns right. people. Get old, it?
Where the This is as close as they get to any, or as close as Jackson gets to any kind of explanation as to why this strange ritual persists. There's some idle chatter about the fact that some communities seem to be letting go of the lottery. So we're told that this lottery is not just going on in this small town, but it's going on in small towns all over the country. And Old Man Warner says, you know, that's foolish, we'll all be living in caves, and he cites it as a sort of a fertility rite, that the lottery assures a good harvest.
The caves thing also makes me think of a nuclear winter.
Oh, right.
Like having to go underground after a huge disaster of some kind.
I interpreted more as he just thought that like living in caves, like some sort of atavistic return to pre-civilization. Yeah. Like he thinks of lottery as basic to civilization.
Oh, on a literal level, I completely agree with you. I'm saying I think that's like a connotation that it conjured up for me. Now, looking at it through what Jackson's husband said she wrote it about.
It gives you this spooky sense of you don't really know. It kind of removes time from the equation entirely because on the one hand, this is supposed to be about a contemporary American village. On the other hand, the explanations given for it are what one would consider like a pagan or pre-Christian ritual to assure a harvest. Again, this is something that I think we're all aware of now because we all have read, you know, Stephen King stories where the town tends, you know, the town is actually run by vampires or whatever.
Or a bunch of X-Men episodes.
Right. But this, I think this is kind of the source of a lot of that.
Oh, totally.
I've read or seen some horror or gothic stories where, yeah, the characters seem to practice what I would describe as like a probably fictitious ancient form of Christianity that involves human sacrifice in line with like the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross and the whole lamb imagery and stuff. I'm thinking specifically of We Are What We Are, where they practice human sacrifice as part of like this really Old Testament Christianity.
Or the Wicker Man.
Yeah, but I gotta say, looking at this through a modern pop culture lens, it was so hard not to think of the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
I feel like Suzanne Collins must have been at least partly influenced in the creation of the drawing of the names through that, because it's a similar system where like families have to put in X amount of numbers, X amount of times, and having like a jovial person being in charge of all of it, it felt very similar.
Eventually, as we mentioned, Bill Hutchinson draws a slip with a black spot. And his wife,
Tessie.
Sorry.
That's my fault. I'm the one who brought Anne Hutchinson into this.
Tessie complains that it's unfair because he was rushed in his choice, which is, it's interesting that that becomes her refrain through the last three pages of this story, is it was unfair. Not, you know, please spare me, not, you know, that this whole system is absurd. It's the wanting to appeal that to her fellow townsmembers that the game be played correctly so that everyone has the right, you know, she's not going to question the necessity for the lottery, nor is she going to try and throw herself on the mercy of the townsfolk. It's that she wants to kind of say, oh, this was an unfair, you know, they're not playing the game right. So after Bill gets the black spot, the individual family members have to draw, as we mentioned before, including the children. And Bill's wife, Tessie, gets the marked slip. And although we've all read the story now, and many of us have read it several times, we know what's happening. If you recall, on the first read, we don't even know yet what is going to be the outcome. It obviously is not something good at this point, and she is quickly ushered out onto the town square, and where people are waiting already.
The children had stones already, and someone gave little Davy Hutchinson a few pebbles. Tessie Hutchinson was in the center of the cleared space by now, and she held her hands out desperately as the villagers moved in on her. "It isn't fair," she said. A stone hit her on the side of the head. Old Man Warner was saying, "Come on, come on, everyone." Steve Adams was in the front of the crowd of villagers, with Mrs. Graves beside him. "It isn't fair! It isn't right!" Mrs. Hutchinson screamed, and then they were upon her.
And the story ends.
That's interesting that I think that the story has her marked as the scapegoat from the beginning. She arrives late to the lottery itself and almost forgot about it, which I like that the story is constructed such that any Like, even if she says it's unfair, like, she is still speaking out against that system in that moment, even before she knows that it's actually her who needs to be stoned to death. It gives you the sense of, like, there's no way... The people who speak out against the system or who rebel against the system or are deviant in any way are the ones that are marked from the beginning.
One of the things that I think is the great psychological truth of the story for me is the way in which, as outsiders, we see this system as insane, but it does capture the feeling of being inside an insane system, and the way that that system perpetuates itself is through the quashing of any dissent, through, and as you mentioned, she is particularly marked. One of the things that's interesting is Old Man Warner is very proud of the fact that he's seen something like 72 lotteries and he's been in every one of them. And
77.
Pardon me?
Lucky
77. I'm splitting hairs. Exactly. I just happen to have it pulled up in front of me. Yeah, I think it's interesting that 77, because that is like a lucky number.
Then we have Mr. Summers, who seems to be running this all. Somehow, the people who are running this don't ever actually seem to be in real danger of picking this. And it's not, you know, it's nothing is there's no claims by the narrator that anything is happening behind the scenes or being manipulated in any way. But we get the feeling that these people are not actually ever in any danger. If you think back to the first time you read this, what was your reaction at this point?
I probably just, like, I got that little, like, cool, like, this is like this is a you know, hair-raising short story, worth my time, worth the 8 pages that I read of it. But
I only have the vaguest memory of reading it. I know I read it in junior high because I was in this advanced literature class where the teacher made us read the most horrifying things. Like, we read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou when I was 11 years old. And then we read Night by Elie Wiesel immediately after that. So I was kind of used to being, like, burned by this teacher. But I do remember kind of having a hard time getting just the image of a very large stone hitting someone on, like, the mushy part of their temple, having a hard time getting that out of my head, because, like, traumatic head injuries really, part of it is, like, a grossness factor, I have to admit, and part of it that it was frightening.
We'll come back to reactions here. Let's move on now to Flannery O'Connor. A Good Man Is Hard to Find was published in, what was it, 52?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Here, I can...
Hang on, I have it up in front of me. It was published in 1953.
And it is also a highly anthologized story. It's probably O'Connor's most anthologized story. Now, I'm going to tell you a story about this that I think is apocryphal, but it's told by my mom. Okay. And I've gotten this wrong. I've gotten things wrong before, and mom will definitely write into Facebook group to complain if I get this wrong.
But it's worth it. But it's for worth the it. Content.
Which is, when I was about 6, maybe 5 or 6 years old, my mom was reading a collection of Flannery O'Connor stories. She had never read this story before, and she was laughing and laughing at the story. And I demanded that she read it to me, and she said, no. Sure, she would read it to me because she thought it was hilarious. And she started reading it. And then she got to the end of the story.
Oh, no.
And she didn't know what to do. I think she's told me that she just quit at a certain point. But as anyone knows about this story actually has a longer denouement than the lottery. And things, when they start going bad, you kind of feel like maybe possibly there would be a way out of it. And then you start to realize that there is no way out of it. Ugh. So... I have a hard time believing anyone actually would have done this to a kid knowing anything about Flannery O'Connor, but that's the story my mom likes to tell, and I have no actual recollection of the story.
You've blocked it out.
Exactly.
I came to this short story. This wasn't the first Flannery O'Connor short story I read. The one that I read in the school was The Lame Shall Enter First, which is arguably a much more fucked up short story than this one is, which is saying a lot. But I was like, whoa, this is awesome. So I have to go read every single Flannery O'Connor thing I can find. So that's how I came to this one, even though apparently it is one of her more short, well-known and anthologized short stories.
This was actually my first time reading the story, was for this episode of Sophomore Lit. And what struck me as I was reading it, because I was deeply disturbed by it, although I enjoyed it a great deal, but it brought to mind some writers who I'm sure were influenced by this story and by the rest of O'Connor's work. I thought of Tracy Letts and his play Killer Joe, which is about a serial killer who takes a family hostage of sorts, also a Southern Gothic. And I thought about the first season of True Detective by Nick Pizzolatto. And I thought about how neatly O'Connor accomplishes in one short story what it would take other people, you know, a whole season of TV or an entire play to accomplish. It's like a beautifully packaged, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like I'm being reductive by calling it a horror story or like a killer story, but it's just perfect, like beginning, middle, and bringing you to this horrifying conclusion. I guess I didn't even really realize how invested I was in the characters' fates until the very end. So I just thought it was really swiftly and masterfully done.
I like what you say about not knowing how invested you are in the characters' fates, because this story starts out extremely comedically, and the characters, if anything, are presented as silly or, you know, certainly casually racist, certainly not very intelligent, a little bit bickery, and you kind of think you're settling into a short story about Southern family life. And then when the tone changes at the end, you suddenly do realize how much you care for these characters. And as awful as the grandmother can be through parts of the story, no one thinks that she deserves what happens to her.
Yeah, they're grotesque. They're part of as central to an understanding of Flannery O'Connor as an author to Southern Gothic type literature. I think she also is a very important figure in grotesque literature. But she's had some funny things to say about this. When people call her grotesque or use the grotesque as part of classifying her work, she said that anything that comes out of the South is going to be called grotesque by the Northern reader, unless it is grotesque, in which case it is going to be called realistic. So she definitely has thoughts on this, and I think that's definitely how we're supposed to read these characters.
Yeah, as an aside here, everyone who has any interest in O'Connor, please read her letters. She was an incredible writer, and she had lots of hilarious burns to her critics. This is the story of a small family, a guy named Bailey and his mom, who is called just the grandmother throughout the story. And she has, there are two children to Bailey. There's
three.
Oh, three. Well, yes, there's three. There's the baby as well. And there's the wife. And they're going on a trip to Florida in a car. And here, I think the point you made earlier, Carolyn, about the growth of interstate travel is certainly, I think, one of the great motivators of the story, because this was not something people did before the post-war period.
Especially as that impacts Southernness and Southern identity. I think that there's a genuine anxiety about Southern states all running together with the arrival of the interstate, which troubles the grandmother very much.
The whole idea of the highway kind of stands in sharp contrast with like the old dirt road that will come into play at the very climax of the story. But, you know, that's for the climax, and we're just getting into the beginning of the story now.
The other thing is that this road is taking them through the modern South, which is also the wreckage of the old South. We're treated to this scene of them stopping at a roadside gas station / eatery that sort of represents what the contemporary world is. But one of the motivators here is the grandmother wants to take the family to see an old plantation home, and that the persistence of history in such a short story, the persistence of history is so important in this book. I mean, in the midst of everything, they pass by an old graveyard, and we're told that the graveyard has, what was it, 5 or 6 graves in it, which is incredibly menacing when you think about the family. But mm-hmm. but that again is the persistence of the old South and the new South.
And she makes a Gone with the Wind joke about right. the graveyard, which is yes. pretty great.
I was just going to say, adding to like the details that kind of sum up the wreckage of the old South, they pass a house with a little African-American boy standing outside who's obviously impoverished, and the grandmother uses a term to refer to him that like he's a cotton picker, and when the kids ask why he wasn't wearing any pants, she's like, oh, well, they don't really have things like we do. So it was just another image of like this woman still thinks of these people as being like slaves picking cotton. And I mean, that's one of the more literal ones, but a vestige of the old South there.
Yeah. And she thinks of these as very permanent states of being. Like, I think when she remarks upon that boy, she had just finished talking about, you know, things aren't how they used to be. People aren't nice anymore. And then she like immediately remarks upon this kid. And I think that we're supposed to see O'Connor's really like misanthropic view of these characters in explicit context of their role as complicit in Southern history.
Also in the car is the grandmother's cat, whom she has secreted aboard because she's afraid that Bailey won't let her take the cat, but she's afraid to leave the cat behind because she thinks he'll die without her, named
Pity Sing,
which is a character from the Mikado. So again, this kind of grandmother is not a particularly culturally sensitive woman.
Something that starts kind of early in the story is the grandmother keeps talking about being a lady, like not just being a woman, but being like a lady. And I thought there was kind of an interesting divide between the mother, who's like a very kind of plain and simple woman who's just wearing a hair kerchief, who doesn't change anything about her appearance when they go on the trip. And then, of course, the grandmother, who's like borderline a Tennessee Williams character, getting dressed up for her gentleman collars, you know, in a fancy hat with violets on the hat and on the dress. Just because she'll keep bringing that up until her death, the idea of being a lady.
Yeah, that's, and I think, you know, that's, I'm going to say as a Northerner, that seems to me like the thing that I find peculiar about the South is the association that persists between sort of class structures. Certainly in the modern day, there's amongst the people who feel that it's a pity that the South lost the war, they look to a time that they thought was full of more gentility and more refinement. Of course, a very small portion of Southerners ever enjoyed that lifestyle, even amongst whites. It was a highly stratified culture. I don't want to get too into this because I don't want to be the Northerner scolding the South, because I don't think that that's my place.
Well, I mean, you can just draw the general conclusion that in the 19th century, so many people were educated in Great Britain that they kind of brought back those general attitudes.
You're not necessarily a Northerner criticizing the South in general, in that the story, I mean, from O'Connor's perspective, to my mind, seems to critique the values of the grandmother, and the values are those values we're talking about, you know, the racial separatism and the glamorization of the old South and kind of an idea of like perceived wealth and perceived nobility.
Also, from a very early point in the story, we get these we get these reports that there is a killer on the loose called the Misfit. In fact, from the very first, the grandmother tells her son that there is this killer who has escaped from prison as a way of trying to convince him not to go to Florida, but instead to go to Tennessee. At this point, it's just sort of part of the color of the story. And I think that's one of the things that O'Connor handles very well, is that when you go back over the entire story, which does come to this horrific end, you feel like she's been fair all along. It's like it's not necessarily something that just comes out of nowhere. It's a story that's about, I don't know, about 12 pages long. And I would say that the first 8 of them are just domestic comedy.
Yeah, she's really funny. I think that can't be really overemphasized. She was also a cartoonist, which you might not have known about her, but I think she has a kind of like cartoonist, humorist eye that I do think is misanthropic, but in the more classic definition of misanthropy, in that you dislike people as a whole, but might like them individually. So yeah, I think that there's definitely this really dark comedy aspect to it that does inform how we're supposed to see the characters by the end of the story. But I think that's also when this landscape of revelation starts to build as part of the setting of the story.
I was enjoying a lot of the comedy around one of the children, the girl whose name is June Starr, which, first of all, great name,
yeah.
Great name. But in so many ways, she's like a kind of a play on like the precocious little Shirley Temple type child performer who's like just gonna brighten up everyone's day. Like, she tap dances at the eatery place, but at the same time, she's incredibly rude and is always speaking out of turn at pretty much the very worst moments to speak out of turn. So I thought that was like a fun little detail to add, this kind of character who I imagine was a play on some of the entertainers of the time.
When they're at the eatery, which is called
Red Sammy's.
Sammy makes the remark here that a good man is hard to find, the titular remark, which is, of course, an old song. Who did that song? A good man is hard to find.
Oh, I don't know.
The song I posted to your wall today was inspired by the story, so it's not right, that one.
No, there was a traditional one. It becomes the ironic title of the story, and I always love it when people put the title of the work into the work.
When it's earned, I think this is the definition of earning the name of a short story. But sure.
Yeah, I like it when I don't feel like it's like it's a punchline. So I liked it in this instance.
The grandmother wants to, as we mentioned, wants to take the family to see an old plantation home in which she said she once visited when she was a child. Although, as the story goes on, it's unclear whether these memories are of something that she really did or not. She believes that it's off the main highway down this dirt road, of course, makes no sense because the highway itself is probably only about 10 years old at this point. But she tells Bailey to go off, and so they start going down this dirt road, and she has the sudden realization that the house she was thinking of was actually in Tennessee after all, not where they are right now, which is, what, Georgia?
Georgia, right? Yeah.
And she gasps, and at that moment, her cat, Pitty Singh, jumps onto her son, and there is an accident. The car flips. They have the wonderful line where the children say, "We've had an accident," all in caps. And then June Starr complains that nobody died.
Children don't come off well in this story. Just as a type of person to be, I don't think children come off well. They're like demonic little figures.
I'm looking for the exact instance of the line itself, but after the crash they talk about like no one was hurt, the mother's shoulder was broken, which is evidence
yeah.
that she can't use her left hand, later she has to hold the baby with one arm, but like the mother is such an afterthought in this family, even though she's charged with the also nameless baby. And I have become sort of interested lately in characters in stories where certain characters are named and others aren't. Like, I just read The Rehearsal by Eleanor Catton, which is excellent. And, oh, I loved that book. I honestly can't say enough good things about it. But one of the characters who, like, has part of the point of view narrative is just referred to as the saxophone teacher. And it's really effective. And I was thinking about the grandmother, the mother, and the baby in this story, who are the only ones, including the killer's, like, minor henchmen, who don't really seem to have names. And I think, I don't know about the grandmother, but I think there is something really effective about just referring to the mother and baby as mother and baby, because then they could be any mother and baby. And I think it helps kind of trick the reader's brain into maybe inserting people they know or their own kind of comfortable, familiar tropes into the image of those characters.
Yeah, I think the first time I laughed when reading this short story again was that the mother is simply described as a young woman in slacks, and that's it.
Yeah. I had to read this book in grad school, and that was actually the first time I ever read it. And my writing teacher gave it to us as a exercise in these moments of description. She said that you should read Flannery O'Connor to learn how to describe things, because she has these wonderful little turns of phrase. Like, she talks at one point about a lacy china berry tree, which is both a beautiful little phrase, but even if you didn't know what a china berry tree looked like, which I didn't, it's so evocative. Mm-hmm. And so I read this the first time that I can remember reading this, going through looking for all these little, like, these little phrases. And the ending of this story had the effect of one of those old internet gags where you are told to trace a line through a maze or something like that, and then a face pops up because I was sitting there staring at each word, like thinking, is this what my teacher wants me to put in my notes?
Good. I think that's exactly what she's intending with most of her work. I think that John sent us an article that was a letter Flannery had written back to members of a class who were trying to interpret A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And she wrote back just saying, like, what were you doing here? Like, she had this, like, Marshall McLuhan in Annie Hall kind of moment. And I think that she was always really resistant to the idea that, like, literature should be read with a decoder ring or something like that. Like, I think that she does try to shock you out of the complacency of, like, reading the kind of stuff that was published in The New Yorker at the time, I assume.
Yeah, well, that class wrote her asking about whether the misfit who we're about to meet here was a figment of the grandmother's imagination, and at what point in the story did it switch over from being a realistic depiction to becoming an interior depiction of what was going on in the grandmother's head?
Good grief. I mean, there's no wrong way to interpret literature, but
there definitely is.
Yikes. I hate the whole everything has to be, oh, it was just a dream. Everything has to be friggin' an incident at Owl Creek Bridge these days.
At this point, a pickup truck shows up with three men in it. One, the leader of them is a guy wearing glasses, and they all jump out of their truck very cheerfully. They all have guns. And unfortunately, the grandmother immediately says, hey, aren't you that misfit we've been hearing about?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's hard not to feel frustrated with this character, even though I think we're about to take a turn into her most sympathetic moments, perhaps. But besides the grandmother, I did think it was interesting. At least the adults seem to have an immediate sense that these three men are no good, because it says that Bailey's teeth were chattering and he had on a yellow sport shirt with bright blue parrots designed in it, and his face was as yellow as the shirt. And we know that he wasn't actually physically injured, at least badly, in the car crash. So I think this is a real turn, not just for the grandmother, in terms of the adults realizing something bad is going to happen.
That's a really good point you make there, because one of the things about the end of this is O'Connor absolutely refuses from the narrative voice to color this with anything other than just sort of the most surface descriptions of what's going on. She's not going to tell us what to feel, but she's going to tell, but she tells us things like what Bailey's reaction is. And that makes this all the more difficult, this last segment. I mean, that jacket will come back very pointedly in a little bit. And the reason that it works so well is that O'Connor describes it just in the most blankly unemotional terms she can. The misfit starts chatting everyone up. He's very calm and... I wouldn't call him cheerful, but he's very sort of brisk and businesslike in his dealings with the family.
He's a Southern gentleman in a lot of ways, I think. He like always says yes, yes ma'am, yes'm, or no'm. So in a way, I like how he's written to communicate with the grandmother on that same level.
Well, he suggests that Bailey and the son, John Wesley, go off into the woods with his friends and says they want to ask you something. That's the point I remember when I was reading this. I was wondering how far O'Connor was going to take this, you know, and you're used to these kinds of stories in which something changes at the end. You know, there's going to be some reversal of fortune here where something will change about the situation and the family will escape, or at least some of the family will escape. But at this point, it just kind of all plays out in a very slow and distressing way.
Yeah, I was really clinging to some straws at the end here, kind of unconsciously at first, because they separated Bailey and John Wesley, the son, from the mother, the daughter, and the baby. I thought there was a chance that maybe those three would be spared out of some sort of like antiquated gender idea, because they talk about you wouldn't shoot a lady, would you? And he doesn't deny that he would, but he says, I would hate to have to.
The grandmother and the misfit talk a little bit about the misfit's past. The misfit claims that he had been thrown into prison incorrectly, that he'd been thrown into prison for killing his father, who he claims died of the flu. But it's not clear what anything means at this point. It becomes very dreamy, the conversation between the grandmother and the misfit. Well, at this point, we hear two shots from the woods, and the misfit's associates return, one of them wearing the jacket. Then there's a little bit of theology here at the end. The misfit and the grandmother start discussing Lazarus being brought back from the dead by Christ, and the misfit not understanding the story.
Yeah, I think that what you said about the dreamlike quality is definitely true. I think there's not a whole lot of drama even placed on the event of each subsequent family member being killed off stage, essentially, because I think we've entered this landscape of revelation where this is where the violence and the bloodshed of all of Flannery O'Connor's stories tend to go, because she her Catholic worldview is very informed by this idea that revelation and grace, as we'll get into, are sort of bought with blood, with outbursts of violence, and you can't really attain revelation without being shaken out of complacency somehow. But yeah, I think that what the misfit has to say about Lazarus and their ensuing conversation is very important to how people react to the final pages of this short story. But I think it is actually telling us a lot about who the misfit is and who the contrast with the grandmother and their interaction. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that.
I also have an idea on the thought of grace, but just like, I don't know if I want to, I don't know how much you want me to spoil. I mean, I know we're talking about a short story, so everything's kind of dense at the end, but just to go along with what Caroline said, the whole idea of she would have been a good woman if there had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life. I think that for me is kind of the core of this idea of grace. Like, if you could be more aware of your own mortality and the fact that in a sense there is a gun being held to your head every minute because you could die at any time, then humans would achieve a more grace-like state if they had more consciousness of their own fragility.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to a deeply Catholic worldview of Catholicism in a lot of ways theologically is about quantifying the unquantifiable, especially when it comes to someone's relationship with God. And I think that point that he was making about the grandmother is that everything she did for reasons of external validation or to be seen as good, to be seen as a lady, and to sort of her morality being shaped by the possibility of being rewarded. So that's not as morally good as someone who would deserve or experience divine grace in their lives up to this point of violent intervention.
So, yeah, let's just say quickly here the end of the story so that we can go into this theme, because what happens at this point is, and this is the other thing that it's heartbreaking, is the misfit suggests that the mother, the daughter, and the baby be next to go off into the woods and join. He says, "Ma'am, would you want to join your boys?" And the mother says, "Thank you, that would be good." She goes off into the woods. And we hear more shots and
a scream, which we did not hear last time, and was just another one of those details that completely pierces the heart.
At the end of this conversation about Lazarus and Christ, and he says life has no pleasure but meanness, and the misfit is becoming more and more angry.
"I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't," the misfit said. "I wished I had been there," he said, hitting the ground with his fist. "It ain't right I wasn't there, because if I had been there, I would have known. Listen, lady," he said in a high voice, "if I'd have been there, I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now." His voice seemed about to crack, and the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. She saw the man's face twisted close to her own, as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, "Why? You're one of my babies. You're one of my own children." She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her 3 times through the chest. Then he put his gun down the ground and took off his glasses and began to clean them.
And then, as Shannon mentioned, we get the chilling last lines where he says, "She would have been a good woman if somebody had been there to shoot her every minute of her life." And the sidekicks are saying some fun. And he says, "There's no real pleasure in life." So it would seem on the surface to end in a highly nihilistic way. But of course, for O'Connor, the grandmother has had this moment of grace and revelation right, you know, at the last moment. And so for her, it's a happy ending, I guess.
Well, you have more Christ-like imagery than ever in the grandmother's last sentences. It says that she half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood with her legs crossed under her like a child's and her face smiling up at the cloudless sky. So you have looking up to the sky, the legs are crossed, she's shot 3 times. So we get those last few little mentions, which I think definitely hammer that idea of grace home.
Yeah, and I think the misfit, in contrast, I think the misfit is supposed to be kind of the exact sort of underside of that image. I think that he is this lone man who seems to have a lot of thoughts on or resistance to the idea of Christ, and he talks about how his father was right and how he distinguished him among his children as the kind who would always go about asking questions. So we get this sort of very explosive meeting of these two characters who are diametrically opposed, and then revelation is and grace is very quickly followed by death for the grandmother. But I do see this in the religious context, but as you said, John, in terms of it feeling nihilistic, I do think that there is some, even if grace is offered to the grandmother at the end, I think that the murder of the family still is performing some function as Flannery criticizing the sort of Southern mindset in her time, mm-hmm. and the murder of that family sort of driving that home. I don't know if you guys sort of saw it in that light at all.
I agree. And also the quote that you pointed out about his father saying, like, you were just born different from your siblings really stuck out to me. It says his father called him like a dog of a different breed. And to me, that kind of spoke to the idea of like nature versus nurture, and the idea that some people might just be born with the impulse to kill in them. And I sort of felt that a little bit about the misfit, although I do think he challenges the ideas of the society he's in. I also wonder if we're meant to see sort of a separation from the nurture side of this, that even though he had these two very good parents, according to him, he broke the mold and, you know, has this urge, it seems, need, or at least desire to kill people.
Yeah, I think Flannery O'Connor definitely writes a world that has very tangible good and evil. The short story that I mentioned that I actually came to first of her work, called "The Lame Shall Enter First," "The Lame Shall Enter First," is a much more obvious sort of exploration of this, in that there is a character who calls himself evil, but believes in God, but knows that his essential nature is evil, and like uses that to his advantage. So yeah, there's definitely this sense of someone again being marked in some way, to recall Shirley Jackson.
And I'm really intrigued by the moment that John brought out, which I guess is like the climax of the climax, where the grandmother says, oh, you're one of my own babies, you're one of my own children, and seems to have a moment of recognition in which she reaches out and touches him before he recoils and shoots her. And I thought, I read kind of a lot of different interpretations of that moment as I was looking up critical analysis for the story. And I don't think that there's necessarily one answer or the other, but I liked the idea not just of her recognizing him in a spiritual way as like, oh, you're my child in a metaphorical Christian sense, but also the idea that, you know, when the henchman comes back wearing the shirt, she doesn't recognize where she recognizes it from, and she's having some sort of a break from her mind in her shock, and that it might be a moment of her remembering Bailey and literally thinking that he is Bailey. So I thought that was an interesting interpretation as well.
Yeah, well, that would make it even more sort of, that would make it ring hollow in some deeply ironic way, even if the grandmother does die in this sort of symbolic revelation. But yeah, I think that that would make it, that would hammer it home in a way that I think is a little bit too too cruel or too like openly sort of hostile, yeah, than Flannery O'Connor ever was.
And I think that the grandmother is basically in her right mind through the end of the story, although obviously you could make something of the fact that she seems to kind of have moments where she questions her faith in Jesus as she's, you know, struggling to argue for her life. I don't think I see it literally as like, oh, she sees him in the shirt and recognizes him as Bailey, but I think it adds another layer to that moment that he is wearing her actual son's shirt.
Let's talk just briefly here, though, about this sort of this conception of grace, because it's something that I find interesting. I think that a non-Catholic writer might describe this as an epiphany that the grandmother has, that there's this moment of lucidness or clarity where she sees some sort of a deeper truth about the world. But in the Catholic tradition, of course, grace is bestowed by God. It's not something that people earn or even achievable. It's just it's a gift. So that I'm a little bit puzzled by the mechanics of this in the story, given that I know that O'Connor is or was a very serious Catholic and very deeply committed to this idea of grace. Is this just a moment of God or the universe reaching out to the grandmother and giving her clarity? And what is this clarity that she gets? I mean, as you mentioned, Shannon, it could be a sort of a metaphorical understanding of the way in which she and the misfit are connected, or is it something else?
Did we mention that we're both raised Catholic? It's just funny being able to have this discussion. I was just going to say quickly, it's been a while since I've been in Catholic education or since I've regularly attended Mass, so I'm not sure how technically accurate this is, but could you, and this is not a rhetorical question, could you make the argument that the grandmother had grace all along because, like you said, it's the Catholic belief that it's bestowed to everyone, but in this moment she achieves awareness of the grace, which so many others lack that awareness?
I'm not sure how that shakes out theologically. I do think that might be granting the grandmother with a little too much autonomy as like a non-grotesque. Mm-hmm. I think that as her status as a somewhat of a grotesque character to me confirms that the grace is that is external, that by the end of the story we're living in this like God charged atmosphere,
especially since she has that moment where it seems like she does question her faith a bit,
or that, you know, Jesus, like a lot of Flannery O'Connor's stories are about a Protestant worldview turning into a Catholic worldview. So I do think that when she just says Jesus over and over again, it initially turns into like this empty plea, and then it becomes an actual like evocation of a religious grace experience. So I think that there it is that sense of being a violence sort of tearing open the character's truth, like they're aware, if we're going to use the word awareness, and their awareness of truth that exists in the world externally and not in them, but it's with violent interactions with the external world that grace is allowed to enter. Like it is a violent metaphor in itself.
I am curious as to what you guys think about something that I was thinking about as I read the story for the first time. From an audience member perspective, I understand why it's very effective to have the family killed off stage, so to speak, because of course what the imagination conjures up is so often worse than anything that can be put down on the page, because you can think of the things that are specifically frightening and upsetting to you. But I was pondering why the misfit was so content with having the family killed out of his sight if that was the only fun in life. Why he let his henchmen do it instead of having a hand in their deaths himself. Why he bothered to take them aside into the woods.
Well, I think it works just from like the mechanics of the storytelling, like for him to have a continuous conversation with the grandmother while members of her family are being picked off. But I also think it has this where we are supposed to see the misfit as like, even if he is essentially evil, he does like draw a line somewhere for himself, and maybe he does see killing people himself as something that he would prefer to sort of have other less sort of worthy henchmen do. But
that is very genteel.
Yeah,
and he does say that children make him nervous. So I thought that maybe was a part of it. Also, the fact that perhaps the grandmother having this conversation with him was one of the more interesting instances of someone fighting back that he'd experienced. So he was actually like getting some sort of entertainment out of having the argument back and forth with her, even though he does lose patience. But I just thought that was a really interesting choice, because I could easily see another instance where he just, you know, in another story where he might have killed
them all. Like what you just said there at the end is how I see it, which is, I see the misfit as being genuinely engaged with the grandmother, even though he plans to kill the entire family off. The idea of sparing them never even seems to cross his mind. He is genuinely interested in discussing theology with the grandmother. And I think that in his own strange way, that is polite society.
I agree with that. It's just very interesting to
so
ponder.
We've come to the end of two horrifically devastating short stories.
Are you going to save this and release it on Halloween?
Well, I could, right? But what I
don't.
I wanted to point out here that there did seem to be a lot of these kinds of stories in high school. You know, if it wasn't this, it was Edgar Allan Poe or some contemporary genre story in an anthology. That I don't know why these are so attractive to high school teachers, except maybe they figure that by shaking things up, they're going to get some sort of engagement out of the students, or they're going to at least...
I honestly think that's what it is.
That's yeah. exactly what I was going to say. Just the entertainment value of, like, you know, oh, we get to read something cool for once.
So any last thoughts on this?
Yeah, I Fauna is especially important to me. I think that's definitely why I jumped the chance to do this. For me personally, I was raised Catholic. I think I might have been raised a bit more traditionally than most Catholics in my sort of neighborhood ethnic enclave. But I was a religious person at the time that I read it, and I am less so now. But Flannery O'Connor's Catholicism is probably the only one that I could be convinced of, because it really appealed to my sort of dogmatic sense of the world as a teenager. And as an adult, I still really respect and get a lot out of her sort of primal view of things as, like, loftily intangible as theology and God and grace. But also as someone who, you know, went to school in Virginia and dealt with a lot of the, you know, politics and history that go into the South, I'm definitely able to appreciate it on that level now, and how it gives me an added appreciation for what she was doing as a Southern writer who was openly critical of Southernness, at least how it was understood at the time.
Yeah, I have never spent a lot of time in the South, so I couldn't really connect with it on that level. But I agree with Caroline, as someone who was also brought up pretty strictly Catholic, at least for maybe the first 12 years of my life. I feel like I've met a lot of people who remind me of the grandmother, either in terms of their personality, just some northern version of that, or in the way that they relate to their religion and their religious traditions. So that was interesting. I honestly can't see myself returning to this story itself anytime soon, because I was so viscerally just horrified by the ending, which isn't a mark against the story. It's a mark for it and how vividly descriptive it is. But I definitely am going to seek out more of Flannery O'Connor's work now, because it has completely piqued my interest, and I just am really excited about getting the chance to read more
of
her stuff.
Could I suggest then Good Country People?
And then what was the one that you mentioned, Caroline, with like a limp?
The Lame Shall Enter First.
The Lame Shall Enter First. Okay.
If you're capable of enjoying Flannery O'Connor, you have to actively kind of enjoy this rising feeling of, like, dread and that sense of horror. But the same might be said for Shirley Jackson, though.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely enjoyed it. And I was all on the Shirley Jackson front. I have so much curiosity about her and her life. And I was very excited when I found out she had written an autobiography. But then upon picking up the autobiography, which I'd still like to read, but I didn't think it would be very useful for this episode, it's mostly a memoir of her children. So it's not, the focus isn't really on herself or her writing. But in my foreword for the edition that I have of We Have Always Lived in the Castle, they talk about how in her later years, Jackson herself became a bit of an agoraphobe and basically refused to leave the house and refused the company of pretty much everyone but her two daughters. And I would be curious to learn more about that and how it affected something like the writing of The Lottery, which came along before her agoraphobia took such a strong hold in her life.
Yeah, I think what I've read of her makes me believe that she always had that, even she had that view of the world even before it became a full-blown condition. And I think her fiction is very informed by that, even though she actually did have a latter career as this, like, humorist housewife kind of writer. I think a lot of her fiction, especially the ones that she's known for, is informed by this very sensitive and fearful sense, fearful view of, you know, normal people, regular suburban types, that, and especially in the Northeast that she's from.
But at the same time, I really appreciate something that you brought up earlier, Caroline, and I don't want to fall into the trap of acting like everything female authors write has to be autobiographical in some yeah. way, because it does feel like with female authors, we tend to look at a lot more like, well, what were their lives like? What were they feeling? Who was the real Mr. Darcy? Who was the real Heathcliff? Who was the real et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So I think that's kind of an easy trap to fall into. It's just in this specific instance, these are two women whose lives have really come to fascinate me. So I think I've got some sophomore lit homework, if you'll allow it.
Okay, and we have some homework for our listeners too. Why don't you guys plug your respective podcasts?
Sure. I host the Loose Canon podcast. That's C-A-N-O-N. And it is me getting to know my guest better through a movie that they like for deeply personal reasons, or a movie they need to defend on that ground. And I think, when do you think
probably
this is
about, in about
John?
A week or so?
Well, in the month of April, we did something a little different where we did good, bad movies, especially those that are adjacent to the romantic comedy genre. And it's really fun. So go check it out.
Definitely. I host a show called Stage of Fools, which is kind of a shockingly in-depth analysis of E's first scripted drama, The Royals, which is a show that is attempting to style itself as a modernization of Shakespeare's Hamlet. So you can find that wherever fine podcast goods are sold. That's Stage of Fools. And you can keep up with my acting stuff and all my other podcast endeavors at shannon-camp.com.
Thanks once again to Caroline Fulford and Shannon Camp. You can find their podcasts, The Loose Canon and Ship of Fools, on iTunes or anywhere else you find podcasts. The Sophomore Lit theme music is, as always, by Malcolm Nygaard. Find him at epochgraffiti.com. If you'd like to write in, you may do so at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Also, you can join us on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page. It's there, just search for it, and then send a join request. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more smart, funny podcasts at theincomparable.com. Remember, everything will be on the final.